What we would like to do now is we would like to go ahead and start our Al-Anon speaker meeting. Can you hear me okay with this thing? Is it okay? Okay. I'm going to ask John if he would come up and chair the Al-Anon meeting for us. We still, with politeness, encourage you to go ahead and have a little dessert or eat something, but just be polite and not disturbing to the speaker. But we got plenty of food, so, and we are very grateful that you guys all came out tonight. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, I'm John. I'm an Al-Anon. And before we get started, I'd like to ask everybody that's got a cell phone or a pager or any of that kind of stuff that makes noise, please turn that off. Would you join me in a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer, please? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We welcome you to the Heart of Texas mini-conference and hope you will find in this fellowship the help and friendship we have been privileged to enjoy. We who live or have lived with the problem of alcoholism understand as perhaps few others can. We, too, were lonely and frustrated, but in Al-Anon we discover that no situation is really hopeless and that it is possible for us to find contentment and even happiness whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. We urge you to try our program. It has helped many of us find solutions that lead to serenity. So much depends on our own attitudes, and as we learn to place our problem in its true perspective, we find it loses its power to dominate our thoughts and our lives. The family situation is bound to improve as we apply the Al-Anon ideas. Without such spiritual help, living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. Our thinking becomes distorted by trying to force solutions, and we become irritable and unreasonable without knowing it. The Al-Anon program is based on the suggested 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which we try, little by little, one day at a time, to apply to our lives, along with our slogans in the Serenity Prayer. The loving interchange of help among members and daily reading of Al-Anon literature thus make us ready to receive the priceless gift of serenity. Al-Anon is an anonymous fellowship. Everything that is said here in the group meeting and member to member must be held in confidence. Only in this way can we feel free to say what is in our minds and in our hearts, for this is how we help one another in Al-Anon. I have asked Susie M. to come read the steps.
Hello, I'm Susie Matthews, and I am a very grateful Al-Anon since 1994. The 12 steps. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for His knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and practice these principles in all our affairs. Thank you.
Thanks, Susie. All right, we've got a great program for y'all tonight. We've got a couple of speakers, but our first speaker is going to be an Al-Anon. And at this time, I'm going to ask David to come to the podium and introduce our Al-Anon speaker.
David Anderson. I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon program since March of 2007. Glad to see everybody here tonight. It's a privilege to be able to introduce our first speaker tonight. I have to admit I haven't been in many Al-Anon meetings with her, But I have heard her share many times from the podium and just one-on-one and just visiting with her. This lady, to me, embodies the word lady. You know, there's a lot of women, but there's not a lot of ladies. And Donna kind of embodies that to me. So without further ado, I was told introducers introduce and speakers speak. So Donna, come up and tell your story.
Hi, everybody. My name is Donna Pickett, and I am a member of the Lake Whitney Al-Anon Family Group. Hi, everybody. Can you hear me okay? Am I good there? Okay. I want to thank David and the committee for having me. It's always a privilege and an honor to be able to share my story with other people. My husband and I made a commitment out of gratitude to the program that without it, we probably wouldn't be together and our family wouldn't be together. And because of that and a lot of other reasons, we like to give back whenever we're asked. We have a little declaration in Al-Anon that says, whenever anyone reaches out, let the hand of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen always be there and let it begin with me. And I got that one. And I try to do that. When there's an opportunity, I say yes, if I can. You know, I kind of have a plan, but I like to invite God in because God knows what it is that you need to hear and I don't. So if you'll say that with me and just let's just invite God in. He's already here, but I'm turning this over to God and let him steer this. Well, I come from West Texas. I was born in Amarillo and grew up in a little place called Dumas, Texas. And they have the Ding Dong Daddies and the Ding Dong Darlings there, and that's what I was. And I was born after World War II. My parents didn't get married till my dad came home from the service. And by that time, my mom was in her 40s, and they really didn't expect to have a baby. But they did, and here I am. And they said, that was it, no more, you can't have any more. So I was an only child. And when your parents are in their 40s, when you come along, it's kind of like, you know, they have their own agendas by that time. And my parents were the most loving, giving people that they knew how to be. I, on the other hand, was a very sensitive, you know, every child has their own perception. And to me, it was like a war from the beginning. And I'll tell you just a little bit about that so you understand kind of where I came from. You know, I have naturally curly hair. And my mom really liked it because that was when Shirley Temple was popular. You know, I look like Shirley Temple with all the curls. She didn't have to do anything. But then she let it grow out, and he had these long curls, and those were her curls. But I didn't like them very much because the kids kind of made fun of me. Nobody else had curls like that. So one day I decided I was going to do something about it. I was going to take it into my own hands. I went down the street, and I had my little friend get the scissors, and she whacked them off right here. And I walked home, and Mother opened the door, and she said, "Where are my curls?" And she was not a bit happy, and she walked down the street and picked them up. And that's kind of how it felt like to me when I was growing up in that home. She had a set of ideals that she wanted me to live up to. She wanted me to be a little girl, and every time she put me in a nice lace dress, I would go play in the mud. And I would, I have to give her credit, though. Part of that was I would drag home every kind of animal I could find. From the dogs and the cats would follow me home, and I would bring home frogs and lizards and horny toads and anything else I could find. And I really liked being outside and being a part of nature. And that wasn't in the agenda either. And that continued while I was growing up. Um, by the time that, skip over a lot of things, you know, it's just a pretty regular childhood. We do what we do, and had my perception of the way things were. It was a little distorted, but that was my doing. Anyway, what I felt like I was missing was that unconditional acceptance that we all want from our parents, and I didn't ever feel like I had it because whatever I did, it was always never good enough. I want you to do it like so-and-so. Or I had these wonderful cousins that were very accomplished, and I didn't quite measure up in my mother's book to what they were. So we lived in a small town, and I started dating pretty young. We'd double date and go to the movies or something, no big deal. And I came across this nice-looking high school kid. And, well, I guess it was love at first sight. Anyway, maybe it was lust at first sight. I'm not sure. But anyway, we wanted to be together. So we dated for a couple years and then decided that we were going to go get married. And we did. And when I came home, what my mother said to me was, "What will people think of me?" And I was ready to be out of that household. And so Gordon and I started our life together. And we went off to Texas Tech to go to school. He was going to college. I was finishing high school. And that went pretty well. There were lots of parties and things that college campuses had, and we participated in a lot of that. And wasn't really a problem. The only thing I noticed was that he didn't get home in the same shape that I did. You know, he might have to crawl to the car. So I started, you know, not drinking very much so that somebody could drive home. And I thought that a child would make things better. I really didn't want to go to college. Just wasn't interested. Didn't see the need at the time. So by the time, let's see, I think I was 19 when I got pregnant with our first child. And we quickly found out my husband had a wonderful job, paid lots of money. And the company closed, and then it was really hard to find another job that you can go to school and work part-time and make a living at. So I had to go to work, and I didn't like that very much because I didn't get to stay home with that baby that I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. My ideal of life at that point in time was I wanted to have a home, have lots of people over, have lots of kids, and just have a happy household. And that was not going to be the way that it was. So, we had bought a mobile home to go to school in, and came home one day from picking up the mail, and it was on fire. Well, they put it out, but there was this big hole in the front of our house, and utilities were out, and we couldn't live there, this little baby. So our next-door neighbor was divorced, and we had insurance, but back in those days, mobile home insurance didn't include living expenses while they're fixing your house, and we certainly didn't have the money to live somewhere else. We were barely making our payments as it was. So we moved in with our neighbor, and it was supposed to be just for 2 or 3 weeks, and it was 2 or 3 months later before we moved back in our house. And why that's important to me is Bill would come home and have a couple of drinks, a couple of beers every day after work. He'd have a couple, he was done. But the difference for me was Gordon started drinking on a daily basis. And when we went back home, he continued to do that. And it was a significant change in my life. And I started reacting to his drinking. And, you know, at first there was the anger and the "if you only loved me, if you you know, all of the normal reasons, and then it moved from anger to resentment to depression to it just kept getting worse. Well, he graduated, and we decided to move on because we wanted to make a little money. We moved to San Antonio, and I got to stay home with the little one, and then we moved to Fort Worth. And by that time, drinking was a major part of our home life. And in Fort Worth, we had our second son. Got up here on the wire. Anyway, Gordon was working for Foremost Dairies at the time, and one of his buddies was working down the street at Miller Brewing. And he said, come on over. You don't have to move. It's a good job. Pays a lot more money. He did. They hired him. And let me tell you, for an alcoholic, that was heaven. They had beer on tap in the break room, and, you know, drinking during work hours was acceptable, and nobody really paid any attention. At least not at first. And that was another significant change in my life. It changed the way that I thought and felt about life. Because now it was feeling like, I'm having to be responsible for everything. He was always a good provider. He always went to work, and he brought home a paycheck, and he did the best that he could. Well, things were not so good on my end. I was going crazy. So I decided that he'd always wanted to live on a farm, and that was kind of a neat idea. I liked the country, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So I started looking for a farm, and we made a geographic cure. We moved to Hill County, Texas, and had a little farm there. And as you all know, geographic cures don't work. And my best thinking got me to a place where I was completely isolated. I did not know a soul in that town. I had two little children. My husband worked 60 miles away. At that time, he was working midnights. He would be drunk by the time he headed home. And that's if, you know, they didn't stop for beers later or whatever. And I became more and more bitter and more devastated by the disease and by my reactions to it. Now, I didn't know at this time that alcohol was the problem because my parents didn't drink. They had a bottle of Jim Beam they kept at Christmas for people who wanted some in their eggnog. I think the same bottle was there when I cleaned out their house. So I really didn't have any idea what alcoholism was. I had no idea what Al-Anon was. He told me that it was all my fault, and I believed him. I didn't know any different. And, you know, I'd been programmed for that growing up, and he just took over and figured out he could blame me and everything would be just fine because I would take it, and, you know, I would take all those feelings that he would dump on me and just own them. Thought they were mine. Thought they belonged to me. And he would go about doing what he was doing, and I was trying to keep the kids together and doing what they were supposed to do, and pretty soon things started to deteriorate. We bought a house and we couldn't continue to afford the payments. He was making good money. The problem was there was an awful lot of it being spent on booze. And there wasn't enough money to do everything, and the creditors started calling, and the checks started bouncing, and you get to where you're afraid to answer the phone. You don't want to know who's at the door. I just started to hide and to isolate. You know, another symptom of the disease was taking over my life. I didn't know that anybody else lived like I did. And I really thought that I was the problem. And if I'd known how to be a better mother or a better wife, it was that if only I knew what to do, I would do it. And I kept trying to figure out what it was Never could get there. Didn't matter what I did, it was never enough. And it just never was the problem, but I didn't know that at the time. I just kept trying to do better, didn't work. Well, that was about the time that the ads were big on TV. We had moved to Hillsboro, Texas in 1978. And it wasn't long after that that I paid attention to an ad on TV about a treatment center and thought, wonder if alcohol is part of our problem. He does drink a lot, you know. There's a lot of booze in the house, and maybe that's part of it. So I ended up going to the Heart of Texas down here in Waco, the Council on Alcoholism, and the fella said, he talked to me a few minutes and said, you know, you might need Al-Anon. And I'm going, what is that? So he said, well, I'll hook you up with a gal over in Whitney, because we lived in Hillsboro at that time, and she'll meet you and take you to the meeting. I said, meet me? And he said, yeah, you won't find it. Well, I don't know if any of y'all ever went over there during those years, but I met them at the place where we meet now, La Bonanza Station. Was that kind of the end of the road? And then you went across the bridge and down the dirt road to the end of the dirt road to a little old fishing cabin it used to be, I think, bar or whatever. And people parked a block or two away so nobody would know that they were there. That's how anonymous it was back then. Well, I walked in and it was dark. There was lots of smoke. People were hugging and kissing. And I really wondered if I was in the right place. Thought, maybe this isn't where I belong. And some of them looked at me and said, Al-Anons meet upstairs. Now, how they knew I was an Al-Anon, I don't know. But they sent me to the right place. So when I got up there, there were probably half a dozen women in the room. And one of them was talking about what happened to her husband. He had decided to go out drinking one night and ran into a tree, and that was the end of him. Now, if you remember, my husband's driving back from Fort Worth every day drunk, and my greatest fear was that he was going to have a wreck and kill himself or somebody else, and that it would be partly my fault because I knew about it and I wasn't doing anything about it because I felt powerless to do anything. He was the only one providing. I didn't have, I had a high school education at that time, had two little children. I didn't know of any way that I could support myself, much less my children. So I made that choice to let things keep going the way they were because I didn't know I had any other choices. And this woman talked about her husband dying, and I went to the bathroom because that's where I went to cry at home. That was my only safe place. I'd go in the bathroom and lock the doors. Well, they were wise to that, and they came, and they knocked on the door, and they said, come on out, it's okay. And they gave me permission to cry in the meeting. Because I didn't have really a safe place to cry or anybody to share with. But the more I listened, I knew that I wasn't alone. I wasn't the only one that lived the way I was living. I don't remember much more about that meeting. Except on the way back to the car, the two women who had taken me there told me about the tool of saying no. You don't have to explain it. All you have to do is say no. Because I didn't know that either. I was still trying to please him. So I picked that one up. But they did tell me it might get worse before it gets better. Because I don't think alcoholics like it when you start changing the game plan and start saying no. Anyway, that was the beginning of Al-Anon for me. In our group, they worked the steps. And at that time, I could go to Corsicana or Waxahachie or Waco or Whitney, and it was all about the same distance from where I lived. So I just kind of go depending on what happened. But it took me, 45 minutes if I didn't hit the train to get to a meeting, an hour for the meeting, and another 45 minutes home. Now, that's all evening that it took me to go to a meeting. And what I discovered was, though, that we have this little pamphlet about what's best for your children. And it said, if you do what's best for yourself, it's probably best for your children. And I knew that if I made that 1 hour or twice a week, that I was going to be a much better mother the rest of the week. So I started making that meeting, but I had a little problem. Remember, I didn't know anybody? Well, I had these two little ones. They were like 4 and 8 at that time, so too small to leave at home by themselves. So I have a drunk to leave them with that may be passed out, or I drag them along with me, and that's what I did. And there was a little room next door where they could sit and read or color, or sometimes we didn't have air conditioning, when the windows would be open, they could sit in our little VW bug, and sometimes they were good, sometimes they weren't. So I have a real heart for people who come into this program with children. And I remember what it was like not to have the money or the resources to take care of those children except to bring them with me. And I try to always remember that when I see kids coming in. Well, things rocked along. They kept getting worse. It just seemed like it was getting darker, and my despair grew. Even though I was going to Al-Anon and I was making changes, it seemed like it would bring up all that stuff, and on the way home, all I would do is cry. And I wasn't quite sure what to do. And I started working the steps. I got a sponsor, started working the steps, and started looking at what was going on in my life, what my part in it was. And we started looking at, was my life unmanageable? Well, that was easy. Take any day of the week, and I can show you at least 10 things going on. So I had to come to understand the disease of alcoholism and how I reacted to the alcoholic and how that made me very sick. And I had to start practicing not reacting. That was not so easy. You know, the knowledge and the awareness came long before the actions. I think some days I still react to the alcoholic. But at least I'm aware sooner and know what to do about it. Well, it was 6 years later before my husband got sober in AA. He rocked in and out. I guess he came about 3 years later, but he rocked in and out for about 3 years. And he finally came, and he stayed. What I really want to talk about is what happened in recovery. When I started working the steps, I started getting the gifts. Step two told me I needed to learn to be still. You know, to let that power work in my life, I needed to be still because I had the squirrel cage going in my head. And what I learned to do was sit and just listen to my thoughts, and if I couldn't let them go, write them down till I got them out of my head, till I could be still. And that was a gift of the second step. The third step, what I heard and what it says were two different things. Somehow I thought I had to know God's will in order to allow God to care for me. Because otherwise I didn't understand how, you know, I was going to follow his guidance and let him take care of me if I didn't understand what his will was. So I had a little trouble with understanding that, but I had an opportunity to practice it, and in practicing it, I got the message. And that was not the God do this, God do that, but it came to the point when Gordon was still drinking that I just said a little prayer to God, and I said, God, I don't think I can take this any longer. I don't know what else I can do. I can't take it. Please do something. And it was the very next day that his work invited him to go to treatment. And I understood what it means to turn my life and my will over to the care of God. That every time I did that, God worked it out in a way that was best for all concerned, and not just me, but everyone concerned, and it was better than anything I could have thought of. And thank goodness I had a sponsor who told me that, you know, living with an alcoholic can make a neurotic out of anybody, and trust was a real issue. So she told me that I could begin to trust in small increments, and that I could also say the prayer about, God, teach me to trust you. And that's what I started doing. That every time I could let go of something and really and truly surrender it, give it to God, it always worked out better than anything I could have imagined. You know, today, I don't even want to try and do it on my own. As soon as I catch myself, you know, being headstrong and have that grim determination, I try to back up and stop right then and say, okay, God, this is your deal. I'm backing off. Just show me what my part is and what you would have me do. Because I know that it's going to be better. And we've had plenty of experiences doing that. The fourth step, the first thing I got was a, a 27, 28-page inventory that my sponsor gave me that came from I don't know where. And she told me to answer all the questions. I started answering the questions, and it talked about things that people did that I didn't even know people did. So it was quite an education. But what it didn't work too well for me, because I had a lot of stuff in my childhood that I hadn't talked about, those deep, dark secrets that we're not going to tell anybody. And it brought some of that up, and I really wasn't emotionally stable enough to deal with some of that. It needed to stay buried until it was time. And then my sponsor at the time had the audacity to move away. And she was the one I'd chosen to trust, and she left me. And she said, well, you can always get out. You can always write, but she was on a road trip, and kind of hard to get people on a road trip. So I waited for a year to finish it. I wrote. I just was miserable because there wasn't another person in our group that I trusted. Except I was driving in this little Volkswagen Bug that didn't look like it's going to make it around the block, and you didn't know if it's going to get there and back. And there was this woman, and she was an alcoholic. Her name was Betty. And she said, why don't you ride with me? And she started inviting me in because I always felt apart from. You know, when I was at the club, it was like they all knew each other. They lived together, knew everything that was going on, and I wasn't a part of that. And it just, it was that same old thing I wasn't a part of. So she started including me. And then she started inviting Gordon and I to her house. And it had been a long time since anybody wanted us in their home because he was still drinking. You never knew quite what might happen. He tried to be on his best behavior, but you never knew. And she taught me a real valuable lesson. She gave me another gift, and that's how to draw people in. And it's something that we practice today, that when we get to know somebody, we invite them into our home, and we like to make them a part of our family. Because there's a lot of us that get here feeling pretty bad and pretty apart from and unacceptable and ashamed. And one of the other gifts that I got from the women in the program was the gift of unconditional love. And to me, that's when they learn to invite God in, because it's God who loves through us that makes it unconditional. And having received it, I was able to start giving. Now, I don't do that every day. And I tell my girls that I sponsor sometimes that, you know, it's really nice to know that we're not perfect. And sometimes I'm moody and cranky and don't feel good or whatever. And yet, when I get still and I work with another person and something happens, they know that it's God. because they know me, and I don't want to be on a pedestal. I just want to be a human. And I make mistakes, and I want them to know that's okay. But that when we get together, something special happens. And God enters our lives, just like He enters these rooms. Every time I go to a meeting, I come away blessed. Because God was in that room, and He's in my heart. Well, the family's rocking along about this time, too. And sometime along the way, I decided to do my fifth step. Now, I'm not doing it with an Al-Anon because I didn't like those women in that room. Sorry, Al-Anons. They were a little judgmental, and I picked up on that. You know, I thought they were judging me. Now, I don't know really what was going on, but that's how it felt. And I know other women go into the room sometimes and they feel that way. And I know, too, today that that's our defense, is that we're the ones that are responsible and righteous and whatever else we choose to be. That's a defense mechanism. But Betty, my alcoholic friend, she was the one who touched me and loved me. And so I asked her if she would do my inventory with me. And she said, well, you know, I've never done an inventory with an Al-Anon, but I guess it's about the same. So we did it. And I set it for a Friday. And then Gordon and I started talking, and he said, well, what do you want to do on Friday? It's our anniversary. And I said, well, I have plans for Friday. And he said, well, it's our anniversary. Don't you want to do something? And I said, I'm doing the most important thing I can do for our marriage. I'm doing an inventory. And that's what Betty and I did. And when we were done, or almost done, she said, I feel like there's something else. What haven't you told me? And that's when, you know, that deep, dark secret popped out that I wasn't going to tell anybody. And for me, that had to do with being raped as a child. And I didn't tell my parents because I was more afraid of them than I was of him. But I'd carried that shame all those years, and I wasn't going to tell. And she made it safe for me to bring that up. And I share that because sometimes I think in these rooms, if we don't share, then other people get the idea that they don't have permission to share. Now, we don't have to share in open rooms, but it's important, I think, to know that we do talk about all those things. So we dealt with that. And the other thing that was going on with me in recovery was that I got really depressed. Now, some things had happened. I got pregnant and found out thought everything was rocking along fine. I wanted that big family. Well, went to the doctor and he said, things are not fine. And we need to terminate this pregnancy. And I said, can't do it. But he said, well, this is not really a choice. You're going to have to do this or you're going to die too. And I had that black and white thinking still that we have in the disease. You know, either it's right or it's wrong. It can't be sort of right and sort of wrong. You know, it was just right or wrong. And I thought it was wrong. So I went around and talked to people, and it was, I got every kind of story there is on that topic, but finally talked to my pastor because they only gave me 24 hours to show back up at the hospital. And he explained to me that there's a bigger picture and that sometimes we need to look at the bigger picture. That I had two children and a husband that needed me and I had a lot of other things that I did, and he didn't think that God gave me that information just to ignore it. So anyway, they terminated the pregnancy, but I got really, really depressed. And in the program, I had people telling me that if only you'd work your program, you wouldn't be depressed. Not true. I think it was because I was working the program, and some of all this stuff I had pushed down for years since I was a child started to come out. But because I was real depressed, I got to deal with that in a safe environment. And I also got to get well faster. And it was a combination of, you know, those professionals and my sponsors and my friends in the program that got me through that. And that was a real healing time for our family, that we were dealing with issues that we might not have dealt with. But to give my husband a great deal of credit there, he would come to those sessions and listen to me berate him And, you know, that's a big part of depression is anger about what happened. And what I know today is that I had stuffed all of that, and it needed to come up to heal. But he got to be the recipient of that, and he came because he loved our family. Well, things started getting better. Slowly they got better. And we wanted to do something for our family. We had these two boys, and they were getting older now, and they had some behavior problems, you know, from living and all of this. They had all kinds of games that they played with Daddy. You know, we had, when they were little, we had this, they wanted to play with Daddy when he was passed out. It was jump over Daddy, jump over Daddy. You know, if you kick Daddy on the way over, you get extra points. In the disease, it was let's go look for Daddy. And then when they were getting better and he was still drinking, it was let's go out to the barn and find some beer and we can shoot it with our BB guns. And then we'll watch Daddy when he comes home and looks for his beer. They had lots of fun games they played. But they were angry and hurt, too. And I want to share one thing that when I wanted to make my amends, well, I want to go back just a second. What step 6 and 7 meant to me. In step five, I really took a hard look at what my part had been in my life. And I had done a lot of things that I didn't intend to harm, but I did. In step 6, what it meant to me was that I wanted a change of heart. I no longer wanted to be that person that was hateful and hurtful, resentful and trying to get even. I didn't want to be that person. I asked God to change my heart so I could be a different kind of person. Then ask him to remove those things that were especially harmful. And then I made my list, and I started making my amends. And a big one on my list was my children. I want to share one story about my youngest son, because he loved his daddy, and he thought he was supposed to take care of Daddy, this little boy. I remember Gordon drove home from work one time, and he didn't think he was going to make it home. He's a little too drunk. Asked us to come get him. We got there. And he wouldn't leave the car on the highway, on the freeway, because he said, well, it'll be vandalized. We'll be here in one piece when I come back for it. So my littlest one, he was probably 4 or 5 then, wouldn't let Daddy drive home by himself. So we're standing on the highway. I'm trying to get them both out of the car. Greg's crawled in the car and won't come out. The other one's sitting in my car going, oh, my God, I'm part of this family. How did I get here? And that was pretty typical. And that's how we got home. One time we were going in the barn, and I had all this anger inside of me. I was angry at him. I was angry at the disease. I was angry at myself. And Greg was standing behind me, and I thought he pushed me into the door. And I turned around and I slapped him as hard as I could. And as soon as I did, I saw that look on his face that, Mom, why did you do that? And he had tripped and fallen into me. But I had reacted out of anger, and I had hurt that child. And I never wanted to hurt him. I didn't want to hurt anybody, but I was doing some pretty mean things, and I didn't like myself. When I wanted to make my amends, he wouldn't allow me to make amends to him. He was afraid. Now, he was at home during those years when I was in and out of the hospital. And, you know, I wasn't too sure I wanted to live then either. And he got to watch all that. And he kind of thought it was his fault. He never talked about it. But he was afraid if we talked about amends that it might put me back there and I might not make it out. So he wouldn't let me make amends to him. And I didn't get to make amends to him until I was in ICU one night. I had had leg surgery and got blood clots, and the clots broke loose in my lungs, and I ended up in ICU, and they didn't expect me to live. And he came that night, and I asked him if I could make those amends. So that's the only thing I need to do to clear my side of the street off. And so everyone left and he stayed. And he allowed me to make amends for those actions that I had taken that were harmful to him. He had these big old crocodile tears coming down his face, and he said, "Mom, it doesn't matter. I knew you loved me. I just want you to stay." Well, that weekend was also the weekend of the Brazos Conference. And as a rule, we were there every time, every fall when it came around, we went. Well, that particular conference, I went into ICU on a Friday. And at every meeting, they would say a silent prayer for me. When the conference ended on Sunday, and the doctor had said, "We can't do anything else. You know, all that's left to do is pray." And I had all these people praying for me. And that to me is the power of the program. Sunday afternoon, I went back to a room. And I have lived through that weekend. Yeah, it was the power of the program and the power of the people in this program that got us through that. Because when I went home, I don't know how much you know about blood clots. I didn't know much. But they can't dissolve them. Your body has to dissolve them, and it takes several weeks. And during that time, they can break loose, and you could die at any time. So they said I had to have somebody stay with me 24 hours a day. Well, my husband's trying to work now, and we didn't know what we were going to do. And the girls came over, and they made a schedule. And they said, "Okay, Bobby's going to be here. Dee's coming now, da-da-da-da-da." And they just worked it all out, and they had a schedule and said, "Somebody will be here from the time Gordon leaves for work till he gets home." Yeah, and that's the power of the love in this fellowship, the way we come to each other's aid when we need it. The other thing that I learned, the gift that I got during that episode was I knew how to give. I didn't know how to receive. And I learned that it's okay to receive. And if I don't receive, then somebody doesn't get to give the gift. And we had learned about acceptance. And we had learned that no matter what happens, if we surrender it to God, then God can transform it to a blessing. And during that time when I was at home and all these people were coming to stay with me, I got to know a lot of people in the club that I really didn't know very well. And we got to share at a level that you don't share with everybody. But it was a gift. And I learned that I had a choice every morning. I learned this lesson at death. I have a choice about whether I'm going to complain about what the day doesn't have, or I can't do what I want to do, or I can say, "Thank you, God, for all that I have this day, and help me to use my gifts wisely." And then I get to live that. You know, with God's help, sometimes I do a pretty good job of that. Some days I don't. Well, I want to tell you a little bit about the boys. I started to tell you, you know, they were having problems. So what we decided to do was program works, traditions work, meetings work. We're going to have meetings at home. And so we got the boys together, the two boys and us, and that was a pretty big deal because they were pretty angry. And we said, "This is what we're going to do. We're going to have a meeting." Now, they had been drugged to meetings a lot. Greg sat in his daddy's lap in AA, and Troy would usually wander around Al-Anon while I was in there. So they had an idea of the groups. Anyway, we told them, "Here are the rules. When we sit down, there will be no repercussions for anything that's said here. You can say anything that you think or feel. Here, what you think and feel is equal with what we think and feel. We have different roles and responsibilities, but in this meeting, we are equal." You know, we'd learned a little bit about principles by that time. And that's what we did. We sat down and we said, "This is how we're going to do it. We're going to start here. And when you're finished, you pass it on to the next person." We had a little talking together. Because mostly in the past, what we would do is, you know, everybody's talking at the same time, or everybody goes to their separate corners. So they started talking. And they took advantage of that opportunity to tell us how angry they were with us and how they felt about this whole deal, dragging them through it. And we had to sit still and listen. Well, it took about 2 meetings like that. Guess what? They got better. They were done. That was all they wanted, just tell us how they thought and felt, and then they were done. They were ready to move on. Now, we were still dealing with it. We're just learning about how to be good parents. But we are learning. You know, they told us to find somebody who does a good job of what you want to learn and ask them how they did it. And that's what we were doing. And we were learning some things on our own. And we were asking professionals how to help us. You know, we learned about I messages. Not I, but I think, I feel, and not you. But to own our own thoughts and feelings and to share them. And that was a risk. That was a big risk because when I shared my thoughts and feelings before, they were turned against me. So I had to learn to trust my husband again. And I had to learn to quit blaming. I could no longer blame him for our problems. I had to own my own part and correct it. And whatever happened, it was my doing, you know. The boys got better, and we decided to take it to the next step. The traditions tell us that we can have goals, and that's what we did. We sat down and we figured out what our goals were going to be. I had decided I wanted an education because, if you remember, there was a time when I needed a job and I couldn't make any money. So what we did, though, that was different, it was our goal, the family's goal. Because we explained that we'd spend a lot of time in the disease when most people spend time saving money for their kids to go to school. We didn't have any of that money. But what we could do was get me through school so by the time that the oldest one was ready to go to school, I could help him go to school. And then, you know, so on down the line. So that, you know, I had to work full time and then go to school in order to make this work. And they understood what all those hours were about because that was part of our goal and they supported it. They understood it. They supported it. And maybe it taught them a little bit about the power of goals and the power of intention. Because I want to tell you, today, those boys are pretty awesome kids. The youngest one's married and has two kids, our grandkids. We think they're pretty special. He works really hard at being a good Al-Anon in his relationship. You know, he learned about we don't stay angry at each other. We're going to work this through and find a solution. And a lot of those things that he learned in Al-Anon and Al-Ateen. The oldest one, well, he kept looking for the right relationship. And then he found a relationship and decided to work in a bar and manage a bar for a while. And as far as we know, he hasn't had any major problems with his drinking. But he got tired of that, and he wanted to go back to school. So he graduated from law school last May. And for a kid that came from an active alcoholic family, that's a pretty awesome accomplishment. And the other one just got his master's in business. So maybe they learned something from those meetings and the goals that we set as a family, because they're setting goals with their family. And they already have money set aside for their kids to go to school. Well, there were a lot of gifts in this program. 10, 11, and 12 are full of gifts for me. Step 10 teaches me to be ever vigilant, to be aware. As long as I stay in this moment, in the now, then I have some idea of what's going on in me and around me. If I start going to the past or the future, I lose that. And I lose the ability to see what I'm doing. It reminds me to look for all those things that were there because I read something once on remove our character defects, that to remove is not to obliterate, but simply to put distance between me and that character defect. And I think of that distance as a spiritual distance. If I maintain my spiritual program, those character defects stay pretty far away. But if I fail to do that on a daily basis, it's like they keep getting closer, and pretty soon I'm acting out on something, and sometimes I don't realize it until I behave badly. But I get it once the behavior's out, and I know what to do about it. And usually I will do something about it. In step 11, to me that's all about my intention to know my higher power on a deeper level, like any relationship I would have with any other person, that I have an opportunity to make that relationship better every day. It doesn't really matter what tools I use. If my intention is to know my higher power better, then it's going to happen. And I can trust that today. I don't have to have a specific outcome. I just know that I can trust God. That if I'm asking for that, it's going to happen. When I was laying in that hospital bed in ICU, one of the things that happened was I started getting calls from my friends from the time that I knew I was in trouble till I got to ICU. And by the time Gordon got there from Fort Worth to Waco, there were people waiting in the lobby for him. What I felt that peace that passes understanding because I had cleared out all the trash out of my life that I knew about. There wasn't anything left undone except those amends to my son, and I got to make those. Otherwise, I was at peace with the world. I was happy with my life, and I had a way of life that worked for me and my family. We had gotten to where we really liked each other, you know, and we could do some fun things together. Now, we had to figure out what fun was. And we're still working on it, but we have a lot of fun these days. You know, we love to play games, and we got a Wii, and we do all kinds of fun things. And I have this special relationship with this fella that I've known since high school. And it's been a lot of years. Can't remember. Anyway, it's been a lot of years, and we've got to watch the disease before it became evident, when it became evident, as it progressed. He watched me, I watched him. We got to see this disease in ourselves and our family. And we got to see recovery. And we get to pass that on. And we do that with gratitude. We say yes when we can be of service. I've served as an Alateen sponsor several times, GR, I'm currently DR of our group, our district. It is a privilege to be a trusted servant. You know, we have worked those traditions and those concepts so that we understand those principles of going just beyond beginning to heal our relationships and the steps, to learning to have healthy relationships through the traditions, and then carrying that out into our world, that we've learned how to live in groups, you know, in the family group, in our work group, and in my Al-Anon group, you know. I've learned how to be a safe person. The gifts that I have been given are too numerable to count. The friends. You know, the friends in this program are irreplaceable. We've seen people come and go. We've seen people that didn't make it. So everyone that walks in that door, no one's here by accident. And especially the newcomers here tonight, anybody who's new in this program, I want to extend to you my love. To know that I know how it feels. I may not be the alcoholic, but I know what fear and anger and despair feels like. I know what shame is. And I know what this disease is like. It's deadly. And I like to always remember that. Because while we like to have fun, I don't want to ever forget that if I don't step up and say hello to that newcomer, they might not come back, and it might have been the last stop on the block for them. I've been given a gift, and I want to be sure that I'm able to pass it on. There's a healing that happens here if we let it. That is probably the greatest gift an alcoholic has ever known, and that a family member has ever known, that we don't have to suffer, that we have a choice to heal and be at peace. And that would be my prayer for you tonight, that you may be at peace, that you may bring peace to the world, that you may be healed and help others to heal. And that all that we do and all that we say in these rooms is held together with love. Thank you very much.
I love to hear a story, an Al-Anon speaker that talks about a family in recovery, and I particularly love to hear a story about where children of an alcoholic family get introduced to the program. Thank you very much for that, Donna. That was a great story. One more time reminding us that us Al-Anons are every bit as crazy as the alcoholics, and that we need recovery and the steps in God as much as the alcoholic does. And I appreciate your message. I'm not exactly sure what the format is here. I'm going to read the Al-Anon closing. I presume we're going to say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the evening. I'll just read the closing and then let the AA, whoever is chairing the AA meeting, start. In closing, I would like to say that the opinions expressed here were strictly those of the person who gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. The things you heard were spoken in confidence and should be treated as confidential. Keep them within the walls of this room and the confines of your mind. A few special words to those of you who haven't been with us long. Whatever your problems, there are those among us who have had them too. If you try to keep an open mind, you will find help. You will come to realize that there is no situation too difficult to be bettered and no unhappiness too great to be lessened. We aren't perfect. The welcome we give you may not show the warmth we have in our hearts for you. After a while, you'll discover that though you may not like all of us, you'll love us in a very special way, the same way we already love you. Talk to each other, reason things out, but let there be no gossip or criticism of one another. Instead, let the understanding, love, and peace of the program grow in you one day at a time. And now, Olga, I'll turn it over to you or whoever's the chairman for the AA meeting. Thank you all.
Okay, thank you guys. Donna, thank you so much for sharing your story. Thank you so much.